are listening to Tech Reads, interviews with emerging technology thought leaders. Our sponsor is Softech, the premier technology trade association that has been serving northern Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo County since 1997. Our mission is to create Softech moments where people connect, explore ideas, and create new business opportunities. Learn more at softec.org.
All of my work is with publishers and authors. A lot of my work is with authors directly on the intersection of technology and publishing. My background, you know, is deep in publishing and also deep in tech. And that's where I get most interested. Of course, when AI came along a couple of years ago, I, you know, hopped on it, having first started studying AI in 1988, when I thought at that time that it might have some applicability. It didn't back then. It does now. And so I'm delighted at this stage of my career to be on to probably the most exciting technology I've worked with since I started.
I'd say you were an early adopter in many ways. And tell us a little bit about the book you published and why you did publish it.
It's funny because it's like, why do we do books anymore? I ask myself that question. I do books because that's what I do. You know, I express myself. It's a medium through which I express myself. You know, I don't do documentaries. I don't perform on stage. I do books. And so, you know, the natural extension of my interest in AI was to express it as a book. And, you know, for all of the great things that is, and for all of the limitations that books bring to an undertaking like trying to, you know, make people informed and aware about AI, is a book the best vehicle? Well, it is for some people, but it's my form. So as I became more and more interested in writing about AI for Publishers Weekly and other places on my blog, I thought, well, I got to do a book. And so last fall, I decided I would do one. I thought I would write it for Christmas. I don't know what I was thinking. And then I got COVID over Christmas. So it's like, okay, so it's not going to be out January 1st. I gave myself a few more months. Just came out in the end of July. So I wrote it pretty quickly and self-published it. And I'm delighted with the whole process. I'm very glad that I took it on.
So you talk about the iterative publishing process. Would you say that your book falls into this iterative publishing, and does that turn all of your readers into beta readers?
Great question. You're aware, Brian, that I use this platform, LeanPub, LeanPub.com, to publish the book. And self-published, there's not enough self-published authors who are aware of that platform. There's also not a lot of conventional publishers who are aware of that platform. It's one of the most interesting self-publishing platforms out there because it encourages a work in progress. They say publish early, publish often is their kind of motto. And so I first offered the book at when it was 75% complete, I put it up on LeanPub April. And people could download it for free at that point. And I was able to get into a dialogue with a number of my beta readers, which helped improve the book. I then did a 90% version, got a bit more feedback. And then I got to the 100% version with a lot of help from my readers. Now, we wanted to call it the 99% version because it will always be 99%. It's always a work in progress. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But from a marketing point of view, you can't go out and sell 99% versions even for $9.99. You have to call it 100% for people to feel they're getting the whole thing. So I called it 100% nominally. What in fact is going on, I've made 10 changes to it since the thing was published just a month ago. And if you download it today off of LeanPub, which you can do for free if you purchased it previously, you'll get a slightly revised edition, more factually accurate, and a couple of factual errors, a number of extended paragraphs. Whenever I have put enough new material into it that I think it's really interesting to a reader, important to a reader to get the latest version, there's a mechanism within LeanPub where I can send an email to all the existing owners of a copy of the book from LeanPub and explain to them in that email what changes are in the book and why they might want to download it again, and which sections to look at in particular. And so I think that's a really fascinating mechanism. The book is available widely on Amazon Ingram, author Olive Ingram. And in those cases, I will download a new version of the EPUB and of the printable PDF and then upload it through those channels as well. So I'll be able to keep putting a pretty crisp version of the book into wide distribution.
Are you using like a rev number on the copyright page so it clearly distinguishes which version of the book?
That's one bug that we're working on, that it doesn't actually say on the copyright page when, and I'm, that's a good point. I'm going to make a note of that to get back to the LeanPub folks to get them to figure out a way to timestamp it.
And I mentioned that because Amazon is notorious for doing print aheads. And also when books are returned, if they're in resellable condition, they will put them back on the shelf. So right. I guess what happens is people are buying books and they know they can return them. So they're reading them or doing whatever. They're sending them back to Amazon and Amazon puts them back on the shelf and sells them to somebody as new. And if you read, I mean, that's their prerogative, right? It's their business. And I'm speaking from personal experience because a lot of times we go through three or four revs with a client. They order the book themselves from Amazon and they get an earlier revision of it. But I always put the date on the copyright page so they can instantly see, is this the latest version, as opposed to having to dig through where the change occurred. So I would say that's a very important aspect of that transition from digital to physical product.
Good tip. Thank you.
So that's very interesting. I love that you're using that as a way for beta readers, because that is something that I've becoming more and more adamant about authors doing, is going through that beta reader process and not waiting for the reviews to come up on Amazon when they realize they've got some problems with it that they just couldn't see. Mm-hmm. So the quality of the work is, AI is allowing us to improve the quality of our work. In some ways, there's very few excuses for poor quality anymore if you are using these AI tools. But my concern is, because content is becoming so easy to generate, you know, you can take a one chapter title from any book out there and work with AI to write an entire chapter based on just the title and some keywords or any prompting. It seems to me the direction we're going, though, is just that the value of all of this content, it's going to be a race to the bottom, right? The commodity of a product, when there's 100 different books to choose from and they're all about the same topic. Do you see a kind of a race to the bottom, and how are publishers responding to the price pressure that has to be happening out there?
Great question. I'll take the end part of it with price pressure. And, you know, to me, it's always been debatable price sensitivity around books. You know, it's not the kind of classic economic model where, you know, there's pure substitution. If I can find, you know, one book at $14.99, another book on the same subject at $9.99, I will automatically go with the cheaper version. I think that in books, readers are more sophisticated and aware that there are more metrics than just the price on the cover. But that being said, in terms of the quality, you know, that can be produced with AI, you're quite right that for, you know, a very basic, let's say a Wikipedian sort of approach to a straightforward subject, AI can do as good a job as Wikipedia. And, you know, Wikipedia on topics, you know, is a reasonable amount of content for a book on a basic sort of topic. And so, yeah, you know, AI can reproduce something at that level. But what I've seen so far, and, you know, and there's a section in my book where I look at, it's called Junk Books on Amazon, and I tried to dig deep into what's there right now in the junk book area, and those books are identifiable. I do find that, you know, for all that Amazon reviews can be gamed and are gamed all the time, with books, you know, if a book has, I don't know, you would have a better sense than I do, but you know, I think like 25 or more reviews. By the time it hits that level, you know there's humans in there. You know, the gaming doesn't go past 5, 6, 7, 10 reviews. And the reviews on Amazon, I think, remain a pretty good indicator and a valid signal for the average purchaser and reader. And so I'm finding that the reviews continue to be a good quality filter on Amazon. I don't know what your experience is with that.
No, I thank you for bringing that to my attention, because there is a challenge that when an author, for example, prices their book at 99 cents, there's a perceived value that for 99 cents, it must be a pretty crappy book, right? Wouldn't an author consider their book worth more? But authors will often do that because they're trying to get some readers. I mean, more important than anything else these days is finding readers, and hopefully those readers turn into reviews. And I mean, here's the thing about Amazon. What I find more and more is even traditional, like other products, they'll do a switcheroo where they'll take a towel that they were selling and it got great reviews, and then they replace it with some cheap imitation. It's the same seller, but they're making twice the profit. They have all the reviews are associated to that ASIN number on Amazon. And so they're really misleading the shopper. But if enough returns start happening, then Amazon will flag that and oftentimes take it completely off sale. And I think authors run the same risk, but at the same time, what you're talking about is the iteration process of improving the book, keeping it relevant. It makes it very valuable. I work with an author, Brenda Bernstein, who did 15 revisions of her LinkedIn book, 15 major revisions because they kept changing the backend platform. Now, she got killer reviews because she was putting in the work and people appreciated the fact that she was keeping that book current. But at some point, she's just like, okay, you can come to my website and download the new version of it, because it was too much effort for her under the old traditional model to continue to republish it. So LeanPub would be a good solution for someone like her.
Absolutely. And you know, to this point about Amazon, you know, you think about a book that's not very good, that the author decides as a marketing methodology, they'll bring it down to 99 cents to get more readers. Well, if those readers are not pleased with what they purchased, even at 99 cents, that goes into the reviews or, you know, the lack of reviews. And so that, you know, there is a democracy in the marketplace that I think is real and still functioning. And you can't, there's only a certain amount you can do to game Amazon. Things do get flagged, reviews do get posted. And so, you know, while there's a vast industry of gaming Amazon, I think it's a mug's game. The best way to game Amazon is create a, you know, write a good book and share that with people. That's the best way to game Amazon.
Bob, you're muted. Bob, you're still muted.
I'll bet I sound better if I turn my mic on, right?
Yes, you do. Thank you.
Anyway, I'm curious about the statement that Brian just made, that you can generate a book in just a few minutes, and quite frankly, you end up with a book that you can generate in just a few minutes. How do you verify the facts? How do you get, I mean, AI notoriously hallucinates. It makes shit up. It creates links that don't go anywhere. It does all sorts of things that you have to go through and do the hard work. So I agree that you can generate a whole bunch of words, but how do you see the application of AI from a detail standpoint of being like right?
Such a good point, Bob. And I agree with you 100% on the problem still within ChatGPT. I've seen it, you've seen it. Anyone who's worked with, you know, any of the chat AI engines has seen the garbage. And it's not like that happens, you know, rarely. It's like that happens a lot. And so, you know, I think it's important for authors to realize, and for people who would purport to game Amazon, if you let the whole book be generated, you know, without much QC on through a chat engine, it's going to be crap. It's going to be a terrible, terrible book, and it will fail, because you know people aren't going to go, "Oh wow, you know, all the links didn't work," and it's, you know what I mean. They're going to pick up on it, and so that's not a suitable trick to pull. I think what you're pointing to is that the way to use AI is not to let it generate stuff and let that fly. It's to work with you. It's a iterative idea engine. It's not a fact engine. It should not be, looked to be a fact engine. That's not what it is. It's an idea, thought engine is how I see it. Where you get into conversation, AI is your intern, your assistant, your coworker. It's not taking over the task.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly use Perplexity way more now just because it doesn't hallucinate. It pulls sources. You could argue the sources it's pulling can be game because it's pulling from Reddit and YouTube, and we all know that there's tons of bad information out there, but at least I can check the sources, and it tends to do a very adequate job in my mind of doing the research for you because it pulls, I think, from Wikipedia too, which okay, when any author, even if they're not using AI, is using doing research and Wikipedia ends up being part of their research, it's just as flawed as AI, quite honestly, because anyone can edit a Wikipedia page. So
Absolutely. I use Perplexity as well. And I do get a lot of value from it as well. And as you say, it quotes sources. I find that the sources it quotes are basic, let's say.
yeah, doesn't get too
I
deep.
love to be able to use, there's also you.com, which purports to be, calling on higher sources. There's also some academic search engines, one Sci something that I was using yesterday. They're an improvement, but they're not a panacea by any means. But what you're really pointing to is, again, this thing like that AI is not a fact engine per se. And people still, because they have the search metaphor in their brains, they think that AI is an eloquent Google. And it's not that. That's not what AI is supposed to be. That's not it at its most useful, most powerful.
I'm curious, AI is a backward-looking technology. It looks backward at the data and generates forward, which means that it is incapable of any kind of innovation and actually draws away from that. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that area of, the fact that AI is in fact historically based, and I equate it sometimes when I look at the results that I get out of it. I look at it, and it's kind of like driving your car home using only your rearview mirror. I mean, it's not a good idea.
It's an
Any
interesting
thoughts then?
point you're making, Bob, but I do disagree, in fact.
Good.
Yes, it's true, it looks backward, but I don't think that that therefore limits its ability to look forward. And I would, challenge you, I suppose, to say, you as an individual who, like most individuals, feels they have a degree of creativity within their arsenal, you look backwards. Right. That's how you learn to look forward, is by looking backwards and building on the experience of a lifetime. And so, that's the kit that all of us use, is the looking backward kit. The other point I'm think about on that side is a real challenge around what is creativity. And we have this kind of, sacrosanct view, creativity is the finest authors, the finest musicians, the finest filmmakers, the great scientists. That's creativity. Indeed, it is. But for most people, creativity, is what they're going to do tomorrow morning when they get into the office, kind of thing. They will bring the creative skills that they can bring to bear on any particular undertaking. And for the average human being, myself certainly included, what we like to think of as creative, the machine AI is more than capable of matching us in a contest. You see what AI can do when you throw even fairly sophisticated, university level tests against it. It does better than the average human. And so, it's not going to be Einstein, but it surely will be better than Thad McElroy.
And I would I would agree with that in the sense that there are days when I feel superhuman, and AI is helping those days become more common for me, Bob, because it's allowing me to take a lot of creative ideas that I have and mash them up and produce tangible results that I could never do in a short period of time. And I'm talking about writing sales copy, coming up with comp titles, coming up with a much better synopsis, utilizing all the assets that I have and articulating them in such a way that I simply wouldn't have the capability to do it myself, not without spending a whole week trying to write an essay, for example, on a particular topic. So it is smart. And when people, tell me if I'm right here, Thad, because I tell this to clients all the time, and I want to make sure that I'm telling them the truth. I said, listen, when we upload your book into the LLM and we start interacting with it, and I use Notebook LM a lot, so it doesn't go out into the general corpus of knowledge. The moment I delete that that knowledge source, it's not being shared with the rest of the planet, but the LLM has learned from reading the book. So now it has the knowledge that was in that book, which we can continue to interact with. And so it's not like it's ripping people's content off information. It's basically reading everything it finds and then putting that in its intelligence, right?
Yes and no. Most authors I know don't even want that. They don't want it to become part of the training set, and which is a legitimate prohibition to want to put in place. And you can indeed prevent it from your work from becoming part of the training set, depending on the tool. It is still a point where it's kind of buyer beware as to whether or not your work is ingested into the LLM and what that ingestion means. It's also this complex point that, even if every author you've ever worked with, Brian, and every book I've ever done, even if we donated them to OpenAI and it, had some mechanism through it, this donation that, would slurp them on into the current data set that ChatGPT calls upon, it wouldn't be able to regurgitate that, nor would it be able to regurgitate something that competed with any one of our books. It's just people don't really, it's hundreds of billions of words that go into these training sets. They don't, they don't go into a database that gets called upon. I think that's the other kind of metaphor that people need to get their heads around, is that, AI is not a database. It's not an answer engine. But because our, the way we think of these things is via the things that we know, databases, answer, Google search, we fit it into that slot, and it's not into that slot. I think, that some of this then leads to, Bob, your concerns around copyright. Do you want to share those, the questions that you were posing there?
Well, I guess my curiosity here is that the copyright protection, if you upload into it and do analysis of the book and work with it like you were talking about there, Brian, you're assuming that the person that just conducted the world's greatest theft of copyright is going to honor the fact that it doesn't go into that database. I'm sorry, that makes me uncomfortable. My concern with it is that, first off, I love the tool, and I think for use, like you're talking about, the functional stuff, generating sales descriptions and copyright statements and legal agreement frames and all of those types of things, it's absolutely wonderful tool. But when it comes to the copyright stuff, you got to kind of start to worry about, is anybody going to own anything when we're done with this? Is anybody going to
own anything
when we're done with it? I mean, you cannot, according to the trademark people, you cannot copyright AI-generated anything.
Right.
And so if it's AI-generated and you put it into a book, you just tainted that book. How is that going to get interpreted? We don't know yet.
I know, actually.
You do? Okay, I'd love to hear it.
I know, even though they haven't told us.
Okay.
And I don't know it top secret or anything like that. I know it because I understand the way this stuff works. And I'll explain why I'm pretty sure it's going to be like X. Yes, the Copyright Office has absolutely made it 100% clear that 100% generated AI content is not copyrightable. So, you know, you let a, you know, create a book with the 100%, you didn't edit it, you just spit the whole damn thing out, put whatever name on the cover, can't be copyrighted. If, however, you go in and change one word, what then? If you go in and change one word on every page, what then? 10 words on every page. One of the chapters is totally yours, but the rest of it is AI. By the time a human has corrupted the AI copy, what's to be done? How do we then declare that, you know, you can't go like, these words are not copyrighted because those came out of the AI. Those ones are Bob's. So that part of the chapter, it won't work, right? So the only way the Copyright Office is going to be able to come down on this is to say that, you know, provided the author has taken ownership of the content provided by the AI engine and has, you know, worked it to where they are willing to say, this is my work, copyright then exists. And it has to be that way. Related to this is the problem of AI detection. I did a whole webinar on that a few months ago. AI cannot be detected in writing if you make the effort. I mean, if you just spit out a ChatGPT, very easy to detect. But if you, Bob, go in and, you know, Brian does this clearly all the time, you take some of the raw content of ChatGPT and you rework it in your style and your phrasing. This didn't make sense. I deleted that, but I added in this other thing that I remembered. And then I found that on Wikipedia and I added that in. By the time that's going on, there's no way to be able to say which part of this was AI generated. So even the task of trying to, you know, prove that a book was created by AI and thereby does not have copyright protection, impossible.
That's one argument.
What's the other one?
The other is that it's a derivative work and it started with the AI, and so it is now a derivative work of something not
copyrighted. But Bob, everything is a derivative work. I hate that the fact that anyone thinks they have an original idea. They don't exist. Even the greatest musicians, if you talk to them long enough, they will say they heard it, you know, they listened to a song that the Beatles wrote and they morphed it. And what we hear today is only iterations of other ideas. There's no such thing as an original idea.
Yeah, certainly
My book, it came from somewhere, Bob.
Yeah.
It all came from somewhere.
But I
think that the important thing here, though, is as we start to use this tool, is, you know, how does that change the way we have to work with things? How does it change the way people read and perceive the work? Because if you use AI too much, it's very obvious in the text, unless you're overwriting styles and doing that type of stuff, it's very difficult to tell one from the other. I mean, it gets very confusing very fast.
I talk to people all the time and say, and I was reading this article the other day, it was so obvious it was AI generated. There's a flatness to the tonality of ChatGPT that, you know, that after you've worked with it, you know, more than 10 minutes, you go, oh, ChatGPT, human kind of thing. And ChatGPT, boring, you need to massage the ChatGPT. So, you know, if you leave it raw, then it gets a bad review on Amazon and filters out of the marketplace that way.
Talk about the personas, bad, because when you create personas in AI, you get a totally different experience.
You talk about that, Brian. That's not something I've worked with.
Well, I thought it was in your book. So you talk about when you're prompting, it's about creating this persona of AI so that it has some boundaries or some constraints into what it's talking about. You can give it personality so that it has some humor. It has a particular Enneagram type. Like the information that AI can pull from, you can upload a sample of an author's work and say, in the style of this, I want you to generate the content based on this. So it doesn't sound as much like AI, but I mean, any comments on that, Thad?
I see what you're saying. Yeah, I was thrown off by the persona, which is a concept within AI that I don't use. But what I do use is a real advocation that prompting remains an art. I wish it didn't, because it's quite complex. And so for the average user, getting good at talking to the AI, which is what prompting is a challenge to get really good at it. What I think you're referencing in the book, Brian, is the easiest way to sort of conceptualize prompting for AI is truly to think of it as a human and talk to it as if it was a human. And so, one of the types of prompts that is advocated is you'll say to it, I know that you're one of the leading experts in this field. I want to ask you a question, and please answer it as would a leading expert. And then you could go back and say, I know you're an inquiring student. Please answer it in a way that's open-ended and reflects your curiosity of the world. So that the AI engine can take on a kind of personality in its responses. The funny one is where you say, please answer this carefully because it really matters. My job depends on getting this right. And you'll get a different response from it, the kind of thing. So it's an intriguing aspect of working with AI at this point that, we're learning how it is like hiring an intern. You're learning what your intern can and can't do, how you need to speak to them, how you can treat them to help them along in their job, that kind of thing. It's kind of fun. I think it's a lot of fun, actually.
Well, and I will say this leads me to my biggest concern about like a few years down the road from now. We are in kind of the golden era of AI because these tools are free or very cheap and readily available and very few constraints on them. Now, similar to like the golden era of streaming TV, that's coming to an end because now we're sitting through ads way more than we ever did, right? Watching Netflix and Amazon. And so that golden era is kind of closed where we're now paying the price. I anticipate, while a lot of these tools are maybe $20 a month, if you did an analysis on whether or not the companies are making any money, they're still burning through billions of dollars, and these big companies are investing billions of dollars, but they're getting us hooked on the quality and the way to do exactly what you're talking about, which is treat them as if they're another employee within your company. But what I'm finding is, one, they're available 24/7. They're far more accurate and they're a lot easier to work with. What's going to happen, in my view, is that these AI agents are going to become more valuable than a lot of human beings in a lot of roles. I'm talking about book translation. We're talking about audiobook narration. We're talking about editing, a lot of other tools. And we're going to start getting charged a premium to use these AI agent tools, even more so than a human being. So now you have to do the trade-off as well. I've got an AI employee, but it's costing me how much per month? Like it's going to come at a premium because I just don't see how these companies can stay afloat, dumping billions of dollars. They've done this before. We always pay the price at a later date.
I'm not in the least concerned about that for various reasons. Yes, clearly it's a loss leader right now, as you point out. They're burning through more money than they're getting from subscribers. But a couple of things come to mind. I mean, one is that it's a wide open marketplace, and we're thinking in terms of the big ChatGPT, Google, et cetera. But what people have not been hearing a lot about is what's happening in the open source space, and there's a lot going on there. And the cost of working with the technology is coming down as the models become more efficient. And technology, isn't priced against perceived value. It's priced against cost for the most part. I mean, obviously there's a recognition of perceived value and there's a ratio there, but it's not the kind of thing that, this intern, you'd have to pay them, $1,000 a week, and so we're going to charge you $500 for this AI intern. I don't believe that'll ever be the kind of pricing model based on that value if the cost is, $20 a week. So between the competition, the low cost of the LLMs, the open source LLMs, the vast amount of players in the field, I think the cost is going to remain reasonable. And the other point to make there, you talk about this being kind of a golden age. It's actually a pretty dark age, I think. Ethan Mollick makes the point in his wonderful book, Cointelligence, that this is the worst AI you're ever going to work with. We think it's pretty nifty, which it is pretty nifty, but in fact, it's such early days for the technology. 3 years from now, 5 years from now, we're going to be saying, remember with ChatGPT and you had to do this prompting and then you go through iterative stuff and there were all these hallucinations. That's not going to be, we're going to look back on that nostalgically.
Wow. That's interesting. Thank you for pointing me straight. Bob?
What?
last question, well, Bob. We're getting down to the wire.
Well, I don't really have a question. I mean, the AI, what people call AI today, has been around in pieces for quite a number of years. I mean, Thad made reference to it in working it in 88. I think the first time I laid my hands on a neural network was from IBM in the early 80s. And, these are just the natural evolution of software. When I look at chat, I look at it's the generative text generation of software for word processing. And that's what it's very, very good at. And, so I love that type of stuff. And it is nice that you can train it and say, read these articles of mine and learn that and save it as a style. And now write this as Bob's style. And it comes out, pretty much in the same style of what the articles that I originally wrote were. So those are great tools that you run into. My concern is not with the cost, because I do think that, it's obvious the businesses are using the heroin drug dealer pricing model, which is give it for free until they're addicted and then start to charge. But I think that AI is way overhyped by the media. It's a great, great tool. I'm incredibly impressed by the tools that you see, but they're just tools. And the media is making it up like it can think, and it's nowhere near that yet. But it's going.
All right. It's going to be a trend. I'll give you a chance to respond to that, and then I'll have maybe one or two questions to close it out.
Yeah, clearly, Bob, it is, the hype is like that. And people make, they overpromise and underdeliver on the hype. My belief is, this is the worst AI, it's going to get a heck of a lot better. Is it, it's back to the earlier question on creativity. I think it does, it matches the average person's ability to be creative. That, we overestimate our own creative skills. And for me, I can only attest to my personal experience. I'm having some profound experiences with AI. I'm doing things that I could not do before. Another thing to point out that I just last night, I was reading an article by Jacob Nielsen, who runs the Norman Nielsen Group, which is a well-established and long-living user experience group. And Jacob pointed to something that really struck home for me and for many of my friends. I'm 67. My cognitive abilities are not going this way. They're going that way. And, I want to try and deny that. They all seem fine to me, but the reality is they're going that way. And what a wonderful thing ChatGPT and associated technologies offer to someone on the downward slope of cognitive ability to bring along as a pal. I think it's extraordinary. Let me just shut this off. There we go. So yeah, I've that's another reason from my point of view that it's valuable.
Well,
I agree with you, and I'm on the same toboggan.
It's like the self-driving cars. It'll allow a lot of us to stay more engaged in the world as we lose the facilities to do so. You know, for the last 15 years, as I've been running this business, I've amassed a corpus of knowledge that probably rivals some small libraries in the United States. And I do see the ability for AI to allow me to find and reference back to a lot of that content, which I look back because for a while I was organizing it by year, and just the sheer amount of stuff that I have jotted down to read in a week, I won't be able to read in the next 12 months. So it has been for me just a door opener as far as not having to store all of that up in my head and hopefully offloading a lot of the storage of that over to AI so that I can focus on the more creative aspects of my business, sort of stepping back and thinking about more strategic level things and not getting like bogged down. And Dropbox is a perfect example. I'm sure that it's months away from having the ability to search all of your content if you give it the rights to do so. Yeah. And how much time do you spend looking for an email, looking for a file, wasted hours over the last 15 years? And case in point, I have a tool that I really insist my clients use, which is a project management tool, so we can find what we need when we need to find it. I have one partner in particular who refuses to use it and just wants to email everything to me. And it's abusive to the fact that, listen, you are not willing to take an extra second and use the tools out there. So you want to basically burden someone with additional work. And it's kind of like, I'm not going to work with you anymore because you're expecting me to do more work now, because now I have to sift through all of your emails, which don't even have the right thread title. Enough on that rant, but my point is the AI for me, for someone in my business and specifically book publishing, Thad, I see it as transforming this industry like nothing else ever. You know, we are going to be one of the first disrupted truly, and it's already happening, right? Book publishing and content creation is being disrupted by AI faster than anything else. Illustrator, stock image sites are a thing of the past already. They've essentially been eliminated overnight because Photoshop has the ability to generate AI images for anything you can even consider and think about. And just from the fact of like what I do from a day-to-day perspective of keywords and categories and comp titles and all the metadata that we talked about earlier, I'm telling you that it's a game changer and literally can make you feel superhuman, because the things that I used to do, I couldn't do, you know, literally couldn't do without the tool. The one thing I did jot down is while it does all of this, it does also create more work, more content that we have to do stuff with, right? That, I mean, you have access to more knowledge now than you've ever had. And do you find that there's almost a little bit of a trauma associated with the fact that literally our brains can't keep up with the sheer amount of information that's coming at us like a fire hose?
Yeah, very good point. The tools, I think the AI tools are, as you're intimating, you know, wonderful filters. And indeed, you know, the information explosion, which has been, a pain point, you know, that goes back decades, right? I first wrote about it 20 years ago, the information explosion. And, you know, it feels worse than ever. It always does. It accelerates. But AI, as you're again intimating, is a marvelous tool for taming the information explosion. I had an interesting case in point last week, because I built all of these file folders. You know, my technique up to now, not using proper project management software like you're suggesting, I see an article that I like, I save it off to a PDF, put it in a folder, and my folders are organized as if I had a filing cabinet sitting beside my desk. It's primitive. Last week I got asked, what's been the total employment in the book publishing industry for the last 25 years? And I thought immediately, I have that answer. It's in a folder. Where the hell that folder was, which file in that folder, who knew? And then I did finally find it. And then it turned out I needed to supplement it with more recent information, which was available online through the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So I had to do that manually. That truly is months away, or at most years away, from a one button response where it would search my files, recognize that it only had information up to 2016, go to BLS, get the up-to-date information, produce the answer. And that to me is very, very exciting. That's empowering because I have a tremendous, database that I've collected over 50 years of working in publishing, and I want to be able to share that knowledge. Right now, it's largely inaccessible because it's buried deep within my file folder.
Well, don't let it die with you, Thad. You should have like somebody entrusted with this corpus of your knowledge so that when you do die, it's not gone forever because it's a very valuable library. I think about there was a gentleman down in Santa Barbara. He was actually a big name in the self-publishing world. Dan Pointer,
Pointer, yeah,
remember?
Dan, I knew Dan.
And he amassed really, amazing library of resources for indie authors. But when he died, his website within a month was down. Like all of that information is sad to say. I don't know who's his surviving member or whatever, but it seems to me there was this golden like ticket, if you will, of
You look in
information.
the Internet Archive, I bet you could find his website through
Oh,
the archive.
that's a good point. You could dig through a lot of that. But if you do, and the fact that it's changing day by day, literally when I say you can't really keep up with the velocity of changes, is you will go to OpenAI tomorrow and there'll be a new button and a new tool that wasn't there last week. And it can be a potential huge game changer. The one that I just noticed last week was there's now a button of drop down where you can actually search your Google Drive and include it in the GPT results.
Is that a ChatGPT feature? Oh, I haven't seen that.
And so you also have OneDrive is an option. So either Microsoft OneDrive or Google Docs. And that's why I asked the question to Dropbox. I said, where's the Dropbox drop down, right? And the response was, well, those two companies, OpenAI has to, I guess, write the plugin for those companies as opposed to those companies, right? I don't know. But apparently it needs to go the other direction. So for whatever reason, OpenAI hasn't yet gotten Dropbox to adopt, that or whatever, but it's coming.
That's a
You
great,
know.
but that's a great example, right? Because that tool by itself is a game changer. I wasn't aware of that. That would have helped me in getting this answer on the employment question. So yes, it's fantastic, right? I mean, that changed everything with one little tool. Everything has been reconfigured again. It's quite remarkable. By the way, total employment in the book publishing industry over the last 20 years has dropped from a peak of 80,000 to just around 50,000. And that talks a lot about the decline of publishing, of traditional publishing, but also the efficiencies that we're able to produce sort of 70, now probably close to 90% of the total content we were producing 20 years ago, with, basically 40, what is it, 60% as many people doing it. So very interesting changes in the economics of publishing and self-publishing at that, between at the same time that dip, self-publishing dip, that's how the industry's been reconfigured.
Yeah, well, and I can just tell you my own efficiencies being, in self-employed. I have a small group of freelancers who work with me, but I am producing more every week than I basically would have done in a month. So I'm basically at a 4x production route and than I was before. And it's all that these tools allow us to do more with less, and have a more reliable source because I think in the traditional business model, when you have to hire people to do everything that needs to be done, you are limited at what you can do and the economics of the fact that there's only so many hours in the day. You have to pay benefits. It's going to limit what you can do as far as an efficiency standpoint. But if you're fortunate enough to work in the digital content space, you have an arsenal of tools available to you today that are really allowing you to multiply your effectiveness like never before. And it's intriguing but kind of scary that this vision of us being in the dark ages of AI, when I see already what it can do in the hands of the right person. And that was the other thing I was going to say is that at the end of the day, An expert who's using AI is knowing how to ask the right questions and knowing whether the responses are accurate or not. Someone who just got out of school and sit down and they think they're going to become a subject matter expert in a topic by sitting down and working with AI, I don't see that happening because you don't even know what questions to ask.
Yes.
And
you don't know answer, whether the answers are accurate. I'm not worried about that either, right? It gets filtered out. The noise gets filtered eventually.
Well, Thad, I really appreciate you giving us a valuable hour of your time. This will be published as a podcast. For those of you who are sticking through to the end, we'll be doing another. Our next podcast is actually with the author of The 80-20 CEO. Bob's very excited about that one. He introduced me, but we'll have another topic, something completely different, but something that is very enriching. And I would encourage you to come to these events live so you can ask questions, because if you were to hire someone like that as a consultant, you'd be spending hundreds of dollars. So this is a valuable use of time if you're able to make it to one of our live recordings. So with that.
Joining you, Brian, because the good questions make me think too, and I learn in conversation, so I appreciate being here.
You bet. And for those of you who want to learn more, it's thefutureofpublishing.com, right?
It is.
That's the best way to find out what that is up to. And the rest of you, it's softec.org. And with that, we'll stop the recording. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Thad.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you for listening to Tech Reads, sponsored by SoftTech. If you enjoyed today's show, please subscribe and share it with your colleagues. If you have comments, questions, or want to suggest an author for a future episode, visit SoftTech at softec.org and click on the Tech Reads link.